Only water, Robert. It can't hurt you. Joanna added, we have run it through every test we know. There are no organisms in it. It is completely sterile. Not now, said Patel. You have exposed it to our air, to our microbes. Ilona shrugged grandly, as if the Hindu's observation meant nothing whatsoever to her, and stepped over to the mass spectrometer sitting on the lab bench between an assortment of small stones and the thick sheaf of an operations manual. On the other side of the manual was a desktop computer, its screen blank. I've got to make a call up to Dr. Lee, Jamie said, getting up from the stool on which he had been sitting. Don't go, Ilona said. This will only take a moment or two. Jamie hesitated, glancing at the other two men, then at Joanna. Please stay, said Joanna. He stood uncertainly for a moment, then gestured Joanna to the stool. Ilona's test of the water took longer than a moment or two. Monique Bonnet showed up, apologizing for spending so much time with her garden. The legumes are beginning to unfurl leaves, she announced. No one but she seemed to care. Tony Reed sauntered past the lab, saw the group, and asked, What's going on? A cabal? Ilona looked up from the computer screen that now displayed the spectrometer's output. Come in, Tony. Come in. The medical officer should be here for this experiment. Experiment? Reed asked, stepping inside the lab area. What experiment? We are about to sample the local wine, Monique said. Reed saw the beaker of water sitting on the bench and immediately understood. Nothing injurious in it, is there? Ilona replied, As far as the mass spectrometer is concerned, it's nothing but water with some carbon dioxide dissolved in it and a barely detectable trace of a few minerals. Reed went over and studied the display screen.
I've seen worse in London's water supply.
Much worse.
I can begin to use native water and the garden plants then? Monique asked.
After the ultimate test, said Ilona, and she raised the beaker to her lips. Utter silence as she sipped. She looked thoughtful for a moment, ran the tip of her tongue over her lips, then handed the beaker to Tony. See what you think, she said. Reed took the beaker and made a show of holding it up to the light and then sniffing it as if it were a fine wine.
No bouquet at all, he said.
No one even smiled. Reed sipped, gave the beaker back to Ilona, then said,
It tastes rather like seltzer, actually.
Monique took an eager taste.
Mon Dieu, it's like Perrier!
They broke into laughter. All except Jamie, Ilona noticed, who looked as tense as a caged panther.
Martian seltzer, Reed said. We can bottle it and sell it. What a sensation back on Earth.
$1 million an ounce, Naguib said, laughing as he took his sip, then passed the beaker as if it were communion wine.
Perhaps we could finance the next expedition in this way, said Patel, after his taste.
The cup came to Jamie. He put it to his lips, handed it back to Ilona with a curt nod, and said, I've got to get to the Calm Council. Excuse me. At last, some semblance of order had returned to the orbiting spacecraft, thought Li Chengdu. The scientific staff was back to its normal routine. The astronauts and cosmonauts had finished the thorough check of all the ship's systems demanded by mission control back in Kaliningrad. A purging ritual, Li thought. The death of Dr. Konoye was exorcised by checking each and every component of the two spacecraft, all their systems, supplies, and equipment. Konoye did not die of an equipment failure, but the controllers in Kaliningrad and Houston insisted on the meaningless checkout. Now we are 12, Li said to himself, instead of 13. That should assuage the superstitious among us, which included himself. He realized that he had been vaguely uneasy whenever he had remembered that there had been 13 men and women assigned to the Mars 2 spacecraft. Everything is back to normal now. The Russians and Americans have set up their equipment on Deimos to test their plan for making water out of its rock. The explorations on the planetary surface are proceeding smoothly. The research teams here aboard the spacecraft have recovered from the shock of Konoye's death and settled back down to their work. He sighed deeply, and James Waterman is back to causing trouble. Li leaned back in his chair and fixed his gaze on the restful silk painting of misty mountains and graceful, slim, blossoming trees. Waterman wants to return to the Veles Marineris to investigate what he claims is a cliff dwelling. Patently absurd. They have not found even a trace of life, and Waterman thinks there was once an intelligent civilization down there. Ridiculous. On the other hand, it would help the politicians to forget about Kanoye's death if we found something spectacular. The remains of an extinct civilization? That would be stunning. Lee frowned to himself. On the other hand, he thought, suppose I allow Waterman to lead a few scientists back to that site and they find nothing at all. The politicians would be furious. Suppose I allow them to go back there and one of them is injured or killed. He sat bolt upright in the relaxing chair. No, that must not happen. Waterman must not be allowed to ruin this mission. The intercom on his desk buzzed, its yellow message light blinking. Lee reached out a long, lean arm and touched its activating button.
Dr. Lee,
said the voice of the astronaut on duty in the command module,
we are receiving a transmission for you from Dr. Brumado.
Lee told the man to pipe it through to him. Alberto Brumado's friendly, slightly harried face appeared on the desktop display screen. Lee stepped over to the desk and peered down at the image. Then he realized that Brumado was talking about James Waterman and the Vice President of the United States. Lee could feel the weight of responsibility lifting off his shoulders. He pulled his chair over and sat in it before the display screen, smiling like a Cheshire cat. The lighting in the dome had been turned down to its low, nighttime level. There were no voices to be heard, no tapes playing, only the faithful hum of electrical equipment and the faint keening of the wind outside the darkened dome. Janie paced along the dome's perimeter, his heavy slipper socks noiseless against the thick plastic flooring, his eyes adjusted to the gloom, his mind churning the same argument over and over again. You know it's a natural rock formation. It can't be buildings. Why are you so goddamned stubborn? But it might be artificial. It just might be. What the hell do we really know about this world? How much would a Martian scientist learn about Earth if he landed in the Sahara Desert and looked around for a couple of weeks? The chances of those rocks being actual dwellings are a zillion to one. Why are you alienating everybody? What are you trying to prove? What are they afraid of? For Christ's sake, we're here to explore the planet, to find out what's really here. You can't do that by sticking to a schedule they wrote back in Kaliningrad. Jamie, is that you? He looked around, realized he was next to the wardroom. Sitting there in the shadows was the tiny form of Ioana Brumado. The only light in the area came from the softly glowing guide strips along the floor and the steady red eye of the always working coffee machine. He padded to the table where she sat, her hands wrapped around a big, steaming coffee mug. "What are you doing up at this hour?" Jamie asked, sitting next to her. "I could not sleep." "So you're having a cup of coffee?" "The Brazilian tranquilizer," she said. He could hear the smile in her soft voice, even though her face was deep in shadow. "I need the warmth. It always feels cold in here to me, especially at night." Jamie wore a dark blue sweatshirt bearing the discreet rocket emblem of the British Interplanetary Society and softly faded jeans instead of the project-issued coveralls. In the dim light, he saw that Ioana was in a bulky turtleneck sweater and corduroy slacks. "Why can't you sleep?" he asked. "I could ask you the same." He wanted to laugh, but there was no laughter in him. "I asked you first. Besides, you know why I'm pacing the floor." "You are waiting for an answer from Dr. Lee." He nodded, realized she probably could not see the gesture, and muttered, "Uh-huh." "Are you so certain that what you saw really was a village?" "Hell no. That's the whole point. I'm not certain at all. That's why we should go back and see it close up. Touch it. Smell it. Taste it, even. All the fancy instruments and equipment we use are just tools for giving us sensory information. Before we can decide just what that pile of rocks really is, we need more information." She took a sip of her coffee. "But you haven't told me what's keeping you awake," Jamie said softly.
"Oh, many things. Loneliness, for one. I lie in my bunk and listen to the wind outside and remember that we are nearly 200 million kilometers from home."
"Does that frighten you?"
"No, it just makes me feel alone." It's strange. During the day, we are busy, and the dome feels crowded sometimes.